Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel.
Today, we're going to talk to Linda Crockett. Linda is known for pioneering the first and only full-service workplace harassment, bullying, and violence resource center in Canada. The clinic offers a safe, confidential, non-judgmental space for groups or individuals to receive support, education, training, advocacy, coaching, and treatment for their psychological injuries. She has also spearheaded the regional and national Workplace Bullying Awareness Week with active government leader endorsement since 2010. Linda has 34 years of experience in her profession of social work, and her clinical and professional training includes a master's degree specializing in workplace bullying. She is an active member of the International Association on Workplace Bullying and Harassment and a proud alumnus of the Workplace Bullying Institute in the United States. Linda, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk. I'm so excited to have you on the show today.
Well, I'm very happy that you have me and very lovely to work with you.
Wonderful. So for those in the audience who are listening today that aren't familiar with you and your work, can you just talk a little bit more about how you got into the work that you do and some of the work that you're doing now?
Well, as you mentioned, my first profession is social work. So in social work, many of you know that we can get our hands into many different areas in people's lives. And so for 22 years, I worked in all systems, like medical systems, criminal systems, addictions, child protection, domestic violence, sexual abuse. And I became an investigator at one point where I really assessed all these abuses. And then I even trained and supervised investigators. So I really had a lot of experience in abuse, what it looked like, how it felt, how it impacted, what people needed. But at the 22-year mark of my own career in social work, I ended up becoming so ill from workplace bullying. I hit rock bottom, was diagnosed with PTSD, and went into absolute shock that what I was experiencing was workplace bullying because I didn't know. No one talked about workplace bullying. No one trained us to identify the warning signs like we did with domestic violence or sexual assault because they're very similar. There's a lot of similarities there and the psychological piece of it, but no one talked about it. So I went into a place of shame thinking, how come I didn't see it? Why didn't I know? I felt absolutely like a failure. And I went into total isolation because I just couldn't believe that I missed it. And it took me quite a while. I had to be very sick before I realized I was in trouble. And then when I started researching it, everything made sense. It wasn't easy to see it. It wasn't easy to learn the truth. It was devastating, actually, and humiliating. But I was so physically and psychologically ill. You know, I could have probably either took my life or died because I was so sick. So as a social worker, we're trained to identify gaps in systems. We're trained to identify issues like this and then put resources in place. So I decided to do the opposite of isolation and silence because that fed those bullies. My isolating, my being quiet, my shrinking and becoming this little shadow of a person that I was really feeding them. And I realized I had to do the opposite. So I started talking about it. I started talking loud about it. I started fighting every system. But I had to get recovery first. I mean, there's no kidding. I could barely talk. I barely had a voice. It was so burnt from acid reflux. I almost lost my voice permanently. But I had to do my recovery work. Then I went and did my master's degree in this area. And of course, blew my mind what I was learning about how much this was actually happening in the world. And we're talking 12 years ago. And there's people been doing this work for decades before me, but I'd never heard of it. And so I did my master's degree. I got certified as a trauma therapist. I specialized in this area. And I realized there was no help in Canada. Everyone I went to, well, nobody talked about it. Every therapist I saw actually made me worse because they didn't know what they were dealing with either. So eventually I did get the help I needed and I started this company because number one, if I almost didn't make it, how are people without my education or systems experience going to survive it? I nearly didn't. Or what about people who don't speak English as a first language? How are they going to survive it? And then I thought about my grandchildren. My own children have been bullied. My grandchildren, some of them have been bullied. What about them? I don't want them to be bullied in school and then grow up and be bullied in the workplace. So I decided to make a whole lot of noise. And here it is 12 years later. My business has expanded 3 times and it's not going away. We never had legislation at that time in Canada, federally or provincially. And today, most of our provinces in Canada have legislation. I would say we're only missing about 4 out of 14 areas. So that's massive growth. And we're seeing people around the world talking about it today. In the last 3 or 4 years, things have really changed. So it's not going away. So wherever you are, whoever is listening, it's not going away. There's lots of hope of change to come.
What an amazing background, Linda. I mean, just like a phoenix rising from the ashes. It must have been so difficult. Like you were saying, you just were feeling shock and shame, and so difficult to kind of finally realize what was happening and then to be able to turn around and turn it into something positive. That's so amazing. It's really, really amazing, Linda.
Well, a lot of us don't get justice. You know, back then nobody was talking about it. I had no help, no support. I had no idea. So I thought I'm going to fight every system I can, because one day I'm going to be sitting with clients who need knowledge in this area. And I need to know what it looks like to walk through all these systems. So I filed human rights. I filed occupational health and safety. I filed a complaint with the HR department. I worked through the union. They all failed me, absolutely failed me. And that's not uncommon, but that's back in 2010. So it was worse then for me here. And it's still that bad for a lot of people around the world, I know. But I wanted the experience because I knew I was going to walk people through. So it was very hard because I wasn't very healthy enough yet. But I still needed to know, right? So I think the more stubborn and tenacious and the more of a perfectionist or go-getter you are, the longer it takes for you to admit that there's a problem. And then therefore, unfortunately, the sicker that you get. So it wasn't easy, but it's the best work I've ever done in my life. And I'm really, really proud to see that there's resources opening up in Australia, in the UK, in Japan, in the USA. It's really spreading wide, especially with Workplace Bullying Awareness Week becoming an international event. This change is in motion and there's no stopping it now.
That's amazing. And that's wonderful, positive forward progress that you've been able to show in the decade that you've been doing this work. So for the people that are listening, I want to start out really simple because there's a lot of terminology in this area, and I want to make sure that everyone is really on the same page. So could you, for example, give us a definition of workplace bullying? What is a definition of a hostile work environment or a toxic workplace? We hear a lot of these terms. Are they interchangeable? Are there specific elements to each one of them? Can you define and use the right terms when we're talking about what we're going to talk about today?
I'd like to simplify it as much as I can, because depending on what country's doing the research, we use different languaging. So to simplify it, it's on a spectrum. You know, the early warning signs are what you want to watch for. And that's the stuff we all just brush off and think, oh, it's just a personality conflict, or, oh, they're just that way. That's the way they are. These mean little comments that are made, the sarcasm, the digs, the negative sort of little cuts here that you get. These are your early warning signs, abrasiveness, incivility. You want to catch it right there before it progresses into bullying, or otherwise known as psychological harassment. Okay. So the way that I define it is a variety of really negative behaviors, comments, and gestures. So we can bully people without saying a word. It could be our posture. It could be our nonverbal, you know, glaring and staring. But think about it this way, a variety of those different things, right? So rolling the eyes, rumors, you know, sabotaging people's careers, sabotaging their relationships in the workplace, sabotaging their reputation. So there's a lot of tactics. And if it happens, I would say 3 months or more directed towards a particular person or group. So prior to 3 months, that gut feeling that something's not right, pay attention to that. But after 3 months, you're probably being targeted. There's something going on here, whether it's conscious or unconscious, does not matter. You don't have to figure out. An investigator cannot determine if there's conscious intent. So regardless, if it's targeted towards a certain person or a group of people over 3 months, these negative behaviors continue and it causes some form of harm, you're looking at a case of workplace bullying or psychological harassment. And if this is still not stopped, it often will evolve and into psychological harassment or psychological violence. And that's when we're talking about gaslighting. That's when we're talking about conscious intent. A campaign of psychological violence means we're out to get you. We want rid of you. We want you fired. We want you out of here. And we're just going to pick at you until you go away. So you see that spectrum from early signs right through to psychological harassment to violence?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really helpful. And the examples that you gave as well. What happens though, where someone says, you know, they're an equal opportunity offender, right? They're just like that to everyone. So it doesn't qualify as discrimination because they're not particularly picking out a protected class, but you know, they're just rude all the time. What do you do if you find that situation?
I think that's a great question because most of us do have in our legislation some protected grounds, right? Here, so in Canada, if I was to say to you, I can't stand the color of your skin or I can't stand your culture or I hate that you're gay, if I make it direct towards one of those protected grounds, that's absolute flat out harassment. Unfortunately, bullying or psychological harassment, I keep using those two words interchangeable because I see them as the same. Psychological harassment often weaves in between those protected grounds. So instead of me saying, I don't like the color of your skin or I make some fun of where you've come from, it's more like, why are you wearing that today? Or what's wrong with your hair? Or geez, I can't stand the sound of your voice. Now, I'm not making anything about your ethnicity, and so I can get away with it. But if you keep making comments like that about a person's sexual orientation or medical disability or intellectual disability, and you keep picking at them about that, it's like I said to you before, death by a thousand cuts. It might not be the first 500 little cut that you felt. You went, ouch, that hurt, or I don't understand that, or did you really say that? It might be the 600th cut. It might be the 800th. We are all eventually going to get worn down by these things. So it's not in those protected grounds. It's usually outside of that. And it's quite insidious and manipulative. Sometimes subtle, sometimes covert or overt. Sometimes it's right in your face.
And so what do you think people misunderstand then about toxic work environments or workplace bullying? What is something that people get wrong about it?
Well, I still hear today that some people think, oh, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the target. You know, maybe it's the target's fault. They didn't speak up or they're not strong enough or they're not educated enough. Or maybe it's like they get it confused with childhood bullying. It's not childhood bullying. We're talking about adults who know better, adults who are educated, adults who are mature, who know they're supposed to be professional, but they still are they're toxic. So what do they need to know? They need to know that it's going to cost them millions every year not to do the right thing, to protect their employees. Employers have the responsibility to protect their employees physically and psychologically. What they need to know is this is causing serious harm to the point of actual suicidal ideation, completed suicides, homicides, and premature deaths. And what I mean by that is cardiac arrest, stroke, or other disease. It is that bad because it's long-term. It's not something short-term. And if you don't see it coming, you don't understand what's happening, you don't really recognize it until you're seriously ill. So what's important? It's important that you bring in somebody who knows what they're doing to train your staff, not just a one-hour check-the-box webinar. That's just irresponsible, in my opinion. And my very strong opinion, if you give a one-hour check-the-box and think, okay, you've been trained, your employees are watching whether you're committed to them and their safety or not, whether you're going to invest in doing things right or not. Your staff, leadership, top down, all the way bottom up, peer to peer, everyone needs to be trained. Trauma informed, in-depth training in order to prevent this abuse, in order to intervene appropriately, whether it's early onset or crisis intervention. And they also need to know what repair and recovery options are available to them. And that is how you're going to have a healthy work environment. You're going to have people motivated and productivity is going to be very good. And your business reputation is going to be maintained, if not even better, especially when I said this change is emotion. So what side of the change do you want to be on? Do you want to be remembered as the employer that did the right thing? Or do you want to be remembered as the employer that stayed under the radar, buried their head in the sand, hurt people, caused harm, and lost money?
In the third sector, there is this concept called the halo effect, where nonprofits will say, well, you know, we're doing all this wonderful work for animals, children, old people, the environment, whatever it is that they're doing. And they are still treating their staff like crap, right? I mean, they're abusing their staff, they're neglecting their staff, they're allowing bullies and harassment to happen within their workplace. So what are some of the things that nonprofits and charities should be looking for to make sure that they don't fall down this halo effect kind of tunnel, so to speak, and say, oh, but you know, all the good we're doing for the world, if a couple of things happen in our office, that's okay. What are some of the things that they should be thinking about?
I love that the way that you put that. And it's such an important point. But I want to first start by saying that this kind of abuse is happening, whether it's nonprofit, for-profit, whether it's nurses, teachers, pastors, anywhere. And I am absolutely seeing it in nonprofits and the charities, most definitely. There's some added complex pieces that I see there because nobody seems to know who is the board accountable to. Because often I get cases where people call in and they're not even allowed to know who's on the board. So let's say the CEO is the person who is toxic and you can't get past the CEO to the chair. Or maybe the chair is toxic and the CEO are buddies or even, you know, family. Well, you're in trouble. You can't get through to the board. Or maybe the board's not even invested. They don't even care. I've seen this happen time and time again. Whether it's nonprofit or for-profit, we all have to watch for the same things. Look at your hiring practices. Are you hiring for merit? Is the person who is being put in a leadership position trained and capable of handling this level of responsibility? Supervising or managing staff. You don't want to hire somebody who is insecure in their skill set, who doesn't feel confident, who might be walking around with imposter syndrome. You want to make sure you're hiring for the right reasons. You also want to make sure staff is trained so that they know what nuances to watch for. Because these nuances, like I said, are subtle and insidious. It's psychological harassment. It's not like childhood bullying where I'm shoving you into your locker or punching you on your way home from school. It's not that way. It's far more sophisticated. We're getting smarter on how to do this. It's happening behind closed doors often. And some people are seeing that, you know, this leader is absolutely fantastic in front of everyone else, in front of clients, in front of donors, in front of whoever it is they're serving. They're absolutely fantastic, charming, wonderful. But behind closed doors, they're Jekyll and Hyde, or I used to call mine Mary Poppins versus Godzilla. And I truly believe she was Mary Poppins because she did a great job. But behind closed doors, she would scream and yell and call me names. So people would never believe Mary Poppins could be so vile. So what's happening is people need to read about their policies, make sure there is protection in their policies, read the legislation. And if they don't know still what to do, they don't feel safe because it's their supervisor, it's their HR, it's their director, it's their CEO, and they just don't know where to go, they should reach outside and talk to someone in their community or in their area that has an expertise in this area that they can talk to safely and confidentially and decide whether this is a case of bullying, what is their strategy, and this professional will support them through that. And wherever they are, if they're looking for someone, they can contact me by email and I can help them connect to somebody in their country or in their location.
That's great, because I feel like so many times with nonprofits, they go, well, you know, we're so small. We don't necessarily need to have a very elaborate or sophisticated, for example, whistleblower tool. And so many times, and it's really unfortunate, what they end up with is one or two paragraphs. And it says, report to your supervisor. If you don't want to report to your supervisor, report to the CEO. And if you don't want to report to the CEO, report to the board chair. And that's it. That's what staff or volunteers or even partners are left with. And you have to sit there and go, think about the power dynamic here, right? Having two paragraphs and all it says is supervisor, CEO, board chair. My God, how difficult is that going to be? Especially as you were saying, if you're somebody where the primary language that the organization functions in is not your first language, or if you're feeling that you are a member of a vulnerable community, maybe even you're a beneficiary or a participant in a program and you want to raise the flag about being bullied in a program, how on earth is that even acceptable? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
Like I said, it's complex. It's multi-layered, right? So in your country or your location, wherever you are, is there even legislation? And if there isn't, then your employers don't have to have any policies or procedures to protect you. So let's find out if your legislation exists. Then secondly, does your policies and procedures include steps on what you're supposed to do? And if those steps are steps that do not work for you because they're not safe, that, you know, HR has proven to you they're not on your side, or your supervisor is in cahoots with the other toxic director, and these things are happening more often than not, then you're going to have to reach outside, because you can't go through this alone. It makes you very ill physically, ulcers in your stomach, cardiac problems, you know, depending on where you carry your stress, migraines, all kinds of issues, your autoimmune system gets attacked. Before you know it, you're getting colds and flus all the time. And then it becomes traumatic. I mean, a lot of people are being diagnosed with PTSD. So you need to catch this and make decisions for yourself early. Go and see somebody, talk to a lawyer, get some legal guidance if you can afford afford that, if you can talk to an HR consultant that is a private practice that understands this, the dynamics of these systems, or reach out and talk to someone like me who does this kind of work. Because we finally exist. That's the exciting thing. The bad news is, you know, most employers haven't taken this training and are doing things incorrectly, causing more harm sometimes, even with good intent, because they haven't taken the training, they're causing more harm.
So one of the interesting things that I've seen people starting to be more vocal about, speaking about it more publicly, and I've been really happy to see it, is this concept of a toxic workplace and walking away and knowing when to just sort of say, all right, I'm out of here. And a lot of times when they're posting things on LinkedIn or on Facebook or whatever, and they're really expressing a lot of the same things that you were describing in the very beginning of the podcast today, and saying how it was surprising and then it felt shameful, and you were kind of going through all these steps of trying to come to terms with what you had been through. It seems that people are more comfortable talking about it these days, which I think is a good thing. But my question for you, Linda, is this just that people are more comfortable talking about it now, or are workplaces becoming more toxic? Would you say that are we 51% good, 49% toxic, or are we the other way around with workplaces these days?
Well, workplace bullying and this kind of stuff is not new. It's just that we're finally talking about it. And I think that there's been a lot of shifts in the world over the last couple of years. Let's say the Me Too movement was one shift. It opened up conversations that we were not having before. Sexual abuse and domestic violence was in the closet for decades. We weren't talking about it. We were blaming the victims. We were doing everything wrong then. The Me Too movement opened the door. I call this movement the We Too movement, just to put a different slant on that. But we're seeing on social media, we're seeing more and more cases exposed. And I mean, it took years of banging on doors and talking and talking and talking for people to finally catch on. I used to be laughed at, you know, pushed away and snubbed all the time for years I was. But I'm looking around now, and yes, we're finally talking about it. So yes, that means more cases will come forward. It's like that pendulum swing. Before, nobody was talking about it. Now everybody's talking about it. Just like with domestic violence and sexual assault, we've got to find that new middle swing, right, of that pendulum. But much more learning has to take place. Research is getting pumped out there finally and showing the evidence of the medical problems that result. Scientific medical information is finally getting published. So that's evidence. We've known for decades that it's costing millions for employers every year for not doing the right thing. So I do think that the answer is yes and yes. Look at the pandemic, for example. The pandemic had all the risk factors that there are for workplace bullying. Increased pressure, lack of resources, conflicts between employees, whether they were working at home or whether they were working at the office, whether they were wearing masks or not, whether they were vaccinated or not. These little groups would form. That means, you know, toxic cliques would be either created or evolving even more. People were learning new bullying tactics, and people who never used to bully started to bully because of the pressure, the fear, the anxiety. The pandemic gave rise to a lot of anxiety and fears and animosity. So you can imagine my work quadrupled during pandemic. I actually hoped I was going to get a break and a little bit of a rest with us working from home, but my work quadrupled. I don't get a break at all. It never stops. It's far worse than it ever was. So the pandemic was kind of a reset for a lot of people, right? Everybody sat back and took inventory about what they were going through, realizing the level of stress or the level of abuse they were experiencing. And unfortunately, most employees that do experience this, either number one, like I said earlier, don't realize what's happening. Like I did. I was confused. I just wondered, what the heck is going on? Every time I speak up about it, something I see that's unethical, I get in trouble. You know, every time I report something that it's unethical and abuse, I get transferred out. So people sat back and started taking inventory and reprioritizing their lives as to what really matters most to them, and realizing that they weren't going to take it anymore. So we're talking about it. We have legislation now. It's in policy now. Absolutely, cases are going to increase, but so are the tactics becoming more and more sophisticated.
Linda, do you think a bully is a bully is a bully, or do you think that bullies can be rehabilitated?
Well, thank you for asking that. That's a really, really important question. I think that we have another spectrum here. We have the spectrum of those who either grew up in homes where there was a lot of chaos. So for example, maybe one or both parents were bullies, and that's an environment a child's going to learn from. Maybe the parents, one or both, were addicts, and that's a chaotic lifestyle. Maybe they were bullied in the schools. Maybe they were sexually abused. Maybe there was other abuse that they suffered and they never dealt with it. And they might have grown up to be very harmful people. Maybe they started their jobs, the very first job, and they were told they were supposed to be authoritarian, take control, be bossy, be aggressive. And they got rewarded for that. They got promotions for that. They got bonuses for that. They were actually hired because they were good at that. That seemed to be the dominant leadership style that I see here where I live in Alberta, Canada. So that right there is high risk for bullying, and people got away with it. So I think over time, they kind of disconnect from that moral gauge that says you can't treat people that way. These people, yes, they can change. Absolutely, they can change. But if they're on that other end of that spectrum, where we're looking at potential narcissistic personality disorder or psychopathic or sociopathic, they can't. They can't change. They won't want to change. There's nothing wrong with them. They're going to tell us it's everybody else's fault. So what I do is I work with that other end of the spectrum, which I think are the majority. They might be absolutely horrific in what they do, but it doesn't mean they have a personality disorder. They've gotten away with it. And if they're held accountable, that's the key piece there, Sabrina. They have to be held accountable. We've got to stop making excuses, looking the other way. We've got to stop justifying it, minimizing it. We have to tell them right off the bat, that's unacceptable. Stop them in their tracks. Do a proper investigation. And what I mean by that, your investigator needs to be trauma-informed, needs to understand the nuances of psychological harassment, because they're not typical workplace investigations. They're very different, so that you can get a valid investigation, hold this person accountable, and you send them into, see some people like me, I do work with them. There's others around the world that I can recommend, so that they commit to a form of rehabilitation. They have to commit. If they don't come in, it's mandatory. If they don't come in, they're terminated. That's what the employer has to term it that way. I often get calls that say, I really like this guy. I want to keep him. He's fantastic, but he's got to change his behaviors. If he doesn't show up, we're terminating him. They'll pay for 6 or 8 sessions with me. And I've seen massive transformations from some of the most awful behaviors to absolute sobbing in front of me. You need an expert that understands the dynamics involved here, that can cut right through that. It can't just be somebody who does a little bit of coaching and doesn't understand the psychological aspect of it. There are some people that catch them early, the wonderful coaches out there that can get it in time. But sometimes it's so deeply entrenched, you need some psychological training in that area.
You raise a really interesting point in that answer, Linda, where you were talking about maybe you have an employer who is saying, look, we really want to keep this person, but they need to change their ways, right? So a lot of times you have high performing bullies, right? You have these bullies who, you know, maybe in a nonprofit, they are an excellent fundraiser. They can bring money in the door, or maybe they're an amazing project manager or whatever it is. They're an amazing technical expert, but they're a disaster to work with. So if there's a high performing bully around, what does an organization need to do? What do staff need to do to raise the issue about it? And then what does management and leadership need to do?
Well, there's more high performing bullies out there than we can imagine, because if you look at the statistics and the costs, you know that they're successful in what they're doing. But in this case, what should a person do? I would say, first of all, the minute you feel that icky feeling in your stomach, start documenting and find a way to document that is safe. And it's not a waste of time to document. Either get your phone out. If that's what you carry with you every day, 24/7, then use your phone as your note taking and send it home, print it off, keep it in a binder at home. And I say that on purpose, because that's part of the mental health that we want to protect. Because when you're going through this, you get awful tired, you get fatigued, you're trying to do your job, you're trying to stay on guard, you're trying to protect yourself, and you're taking notes, you get fatigued. And when you get fatigued, you forget. When you forget, you get insecure, because then you get doubtful. So we want you to document. We want you to keep it in a safe place at home, one binder, keep your notes in there. Any nasty emails, any voice text messages, snapshot them, print them off, keep them in one place. That's going to help your mental health. Because the first thing that we do is start ruminating about, did I see that? Did that actually happen? I forgot. You're going to have your notes there for clarity. Look at your policies and your procedures. Print them off and keep them in that binder too. Know what your employer expects you to do. What is your legislation? Know that as well. Who is the safe person that you can talk to? Is there someone? Are you unionized? Talk to your union. If everyone there is useless, and I'm sorry to use that word, but it often is, they don't know what they're doing either. They don't know how to handle it. Keep going. Don't give up. There are people out there that will talk to you about your case. Get a case assessment. Just talk to somebody. I want a sanity check. Can you talk to me? You can do it over the phone, virtually, or in person. A consultant or a coach, therapist like myself. Start talking about it. Don't isolate. Avoid isolation, because that takes you down another rabbit hole. Self-doubt is one of the things that kicks in. You start questioning what you saw, what you heard, what you feel. If you're going through that right now, you know something's not right. You need to talk to somebody.
Absolutely. A lot of times in the third sector, people go into this work because their heart is really in it. They believe in the mission. They believe in the objectives of the organization that they're working for. They truly want to make the world a better place. And folks like that tend to not give up pretty easily. And so maybe if they find themselves in a really bad situation, they'll reflect on themselves and say, well, you know, what can I do differently? What can I try and do this? Can I keep my head down? Whatever they think their solution can be. What are the red flags for when you just need to pack it up and walk away? It's hard for charity and nonprofit workers to walk away, but you know, from your expertise, when is the right time to walk away?
Well, if I had a dollar for every time I've heard somebody say to me, I love my job, I don't want to leave. Why won't they just leave me alone so I can do my job? I would be very rich. You know, in social work, we love our job. We're in it to help other people. I'm a trauma therapist. I'm in it because I want to help other people. In charities, we're in it by choice because we want to do right. We want to do good in the world. So one of the characteristics that I see in the clients that come in because they've been injured, and I say that word on purpose, injured by bullying and harassment in the workplace, it's usually after they've denied a lot of their own body signals. They've denied themselves the knot in their gut, the fire in their belly. They've denied the tension in their necks. They've denied themselves rest. They try to work harder. They work through their lunches. They work overtime. They come in on Saturdays, they try to do better. I'm even talking about myself here because I did that too. I thought if I worked more, did better, tried harder, they would get off my back and leave me alone. Well, actually, we are making things worse because we cannot fix it. If you've got a true blue bully in the workplace, I'm sorry, you're not working isn't the problem. The fact is you're some threat of some kind, because happy, competent, secure people do not bully. Insecure, incompetent people bully. And incompetent in skill sets is what I mean. Okay, so insecures, imposter syndrome, they're the ones who are acting out and bullying and trying to oppress and suppress you because there's something in you that is a threat to them. Maybe it's because you're very skilled, you're very likable, you're a go-getter, you're independent. Maybe you go above the call of duty. I'm describing all my clients, by the way. There's a consistency with every single client I have. But the problem we have as people who are targeted is that we deny our own bodies our own needs because we don't listen to it. So we end up sick instead. That's why we're walking through my door, barely able to say a word. You know, you're just such a mess. Don't wait so long. Make your health a priority. Listen to your body. Have healthy workplace boundaries. See someone that can help you, either a coach or a therapist, that can help you identify your own boundaries, your own level of self-esteem, self-worth, self-value. Your self-insight is absolutely key. So stop denying yourself that. There is no job worth your death. There's no job worth it. We already know of a fellow who died at his desk of a heart attack. I know of another fellow who died at his desk of a heart attack. We know of people who have committed suicide. We know of people who have committed homicide. You don't want to get to that place where it's driven you so bad to such a psychotic breakdown like that. You want to catch your signs, care enough about yourself. Unfortunately, I had to walk away from a job that I loved and I grieved. It is a process of grief and loss because I loved my job. I was working in a cancer center. I loved the people I worked with. I loved what I did. I wanted to dig my heels in and commit to that. That would be my final job in my life. But I had to leave. With or without justice, you have to put your health first and your recovery first, with or without justice. Justice can come in other ways. I've certainly found my justice by doing the work that I do, but you can't let a job that take your life. So if you've tried everything else to stand up for yourself, to file a complaint, to speak outside to someone in confidence, and it's still not working and it's killing you, you're not sleeping, you're having anxiety and panic attacks, you're feeling sick all the time, you're fearful, you're crying on the way into work, you're hiding, you need help. And I would say get help before you quit.
Those are some really, really good and serious and sad and scary red flags. I bet there's people who are listening who are going, oh my God, she's describing my life right now. And that's hard. That is a hard place to be in for people. So yeah, protect your health. That's probably the best advice for when to walk away.
It almost kind of hurts to even think that when we realize that we haven't been taking good care of ourselves, that we've been ignoring or we'll jump to the pump to help everybody else, but we will ignore our own signs.
A lot in the third sector, people who are givers, they give, and then they realize that their own bucket is empty. So what happens if maybe somebody is listening to this podcast today and they're listening to what you're describing and all of a sudden a light bulb goes off over their head and they have enough sort of self-awareness and they go, oh my God, I've done this before. I'm a bully. What should they do? What should happen then?
Well, fantastic question again, because, you know, I have had people come to me and say, you know, I think I might be a bully. Could I work with you and just, you know, change maybe some of my behaviors? And right away, I'm going to go, wow, that's fantastic that you have that insight and willingness. That to me said is you're not a true blue bully, but you might have some areas that you need to soften in. So yeah, we can work with that. I have a questionnaire. Am I a bully or am I being bullied? It's a self-assessment, right? So it just asks some questions, you determine, and then reach out to somebody like a coach or a therapist who can help you decide. There's also many free on Google search. What is my conflict management style? What kind of a leader am I? Or where's my self-esteem? Where is my self-worth? You can measure these things by yourself and just get a sense of where you're at with that, because there is risk factors, right? So if you want to do some self-assessment, talk to somebody, ask for feedback, but true blue bullies won't ask that question, Sabrina.
I'm just trying to think positive, Linda. I'm just trying to think positive. But I think, you know, that self-assessment might be useful. Maybe somebody will download it and take a look at it and might discover something about themselves. We talk a lot about blind spots when we're trying to grow as leaders and being able to identify your blind spots. And so being brave enough and strong enough to sit down and say, well, wait a minute, maybe I'll take this as self-assessment and see where I shake out on it, could give people some insight maybe into what they're doing.
But you're absolutely right. In the early stages of somebody starting these behaviors, where they get away with it and they get away with it and they go away and they become a true blue bully, they're not going to ask that question. But if they do their assessment in the early stages, they might be able to make those changes in time before they cause other people harm. So you're absolutely right there.
We're going to try and think positive with that, all the negativity. We're going to try and think positive. Let me ask you so about leadership and management then. So let's say you are a team leader or a unit leader or unit manager, and you realize you have a bully on your staff. What's some advice for folks who, again, maybe working in small to medium-sized, low-resourced, no-resourced organizations. Maybe they don't have an HR department. Maybe they don't have a legal department. If you're just kind of caught there and said, wow, okay, I have a bully on my team, what are some things that they can do?
Well, the first thing that I would do if I was in that situation is I would reach out to somebody who is experienced and a specialist in this area and ask for a consultation. And that's what leaders are doing. They're calling and asking for consultations. This is what I've got. This is what's happening. What should I do? So there's kind of like a triage process. You know, you don't have to jump right into complaints. You don't have to jump right into investigation. You want to talk to a specialist and see what would be the best way. What stages are we at? What type of bully do we have? Has there been harm? Because mediation, in my opinion, is good before any harm. But if somebody's been harmed, you don't want to bring a mediator in. You need something more than that. So a consultation will assess what kind of bullying, what kind of harm has occurred, what would be the next best steps.
It might be coming to see somebody who does the work I do with this person, this man or woman, where I can work with them. Or maybe it's gone to the other extreme. It's time to file a formal complaint and bring in an investigator. And I have to say to leaders out there, a lot of your HR people are not trained in psychological harassment investigations. So make sure you either send them for training or hire a third party investigator. There's no risk of any bias whatsoever, because workplace bullying takes safety away. You want to give safety back. So if there's any risk bias, any risk of lack of experience, you might be causing some further harm or damaging that investigation. So if you want to work with this person, you want to keep this person, catch it early, have a consult with someone like me, or I can recommend people around the world, and develop a strategy that is best for your situation, because every case is unique.
I think your point about trying to have mediation after harm has occurred is a great point to really emphasize. I feel like a lot of times when somebody is brave enough to finally speak up and say, I feel like I'm being harassed, I feel like I'm being bullied, I feel like I'm having to function in a toxic work environment, management or leadership just goes, oh, okay, well, let's try and have a counseling session or a mediation session. And it's really scary and horrifying and frightening, but that seems to be like the default, right? Or it's like, oh, well, this person will get coaching and they get two sessions of coaching and then everything is fine again. I think that's really such a good point, and I want to emphasize it for leaders who are listening to this. Look, if someone's come to you and said, harm has already happened to me, don't make them sit down in a room with a bully. I mean, is that good advice?
I want to say, first of all, would we make a domestic violence survivor sit down with the person has been beaten them and say, hey, let's talk about it? Would we do that with sexual assault victims? Hey, let's talk about it. It doesn't work. You're talking about somebody they don't trust, they don't feel safe, their psychological safety has been taken from them. And this person who has been harming them has potentially been manipulating and conning you as a leader. And they could do the very same thing with the mediator. The mediator might not be trained in these nuances either. So if there's harm, and what I mean by harm is loss of safety, there's depression or anxiety or panic attacks or just fear. That's harm. They're physically ill. That's harm. These are illnesses, yes, diagnoses potentially, but these are injuries that you, when you started the job, you were fine. You never had an anxiety, never had a panic attack, never had depression, never thought about suicide, never wondered why you chose this job in the first place. Until you were bullied, you were perfectly fine. So this is an injury. So people have to realize that you're causing more harm when you put them into situations of mediations that have not been trained. You want to look at facilitated conversations. You want to look at perhaps getting both of them a therapist, both of them a coach, maybe facilitate that coming together at some point. But every case is unique.
That's great advice. You had mentioned earlier in our conversation about boards and about boards' involvement. In some organizations, they may not even make their board public. I'm hoping that in the organizations where the people are listening to this show know who their board members are and their board members are public. But again, we're thinking about small to medium-sized organizations, and the board members might just be people in the community who are passionate about a particular topic, but not really well-versed in what's going on. So I try here on Tolerable Risk to make sure that we're providing some advice and guidance for board members, trustees. So what would be three questions that you would suggest for board members to be asking of their leadership and management relating to workplace bullying and things that we've been discussing, so that the board members can really demonstrate that this is an important topic and they want it to be an important topic in the organization as well?
Well, I guess you want to look at patterns and trends. You know, are you maintaining your staff, or is recruitment, you know, you're seeing them coming and going. You want to look at patterns of sick leave as well. You want to get a feel for where staff is at. Are they staying or are they on sick leave all the time? What's going on here? You want to ask, do we have policies and procedures that protect our employees? Are they aligning with the legislation? And do we have resources available for people and procedures that make it safe? Safe to report, and safe alternate reporting steps as well. And where are we at with that? But what if that person that they're asking is the person who's toxic? So, you know, that's why I kind of hesitate to answer that, because often the person they're asking for feedback is not giving them the full picture. I'm sure there's nodding heads right now. They're not getting the full picture of what's going on in their staff. So board members need to be trained on what to ask and what to see and what to look for, despite what feedback they're getting from their CEO or directors. Board members need to be trained just as importantly as every other leader in the organization. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing that happen.
That's a really interesting point. We've had some other guests on the podcast who have emphasized to board members the importance of asking for the unfiltered information. Right. So specifically saying, I want to invite this particular role to come and speak with us, or requesting some sort of survey or things like that, so that they can get the information unfiltered, as opposed to going through the CFO for the risk committee or the CEO right. for the executive committee and all of that. So really making sure that board members and trustees feel empowered to ask for the raw information, and that they're asking the right questions, because we know we don't want the board members to start getting involved up to their elbows in the day-to-day operations. That's not really what they're there for. But at the same time, whatever they're asking about is going to be what management's going to be focusing on. And so if they're asking the right questions about these areas, then maybe they'll communicate to management that this is an important area.
Well, I think that's a great idea. But again, if the leaders are people that are the ones that are toxic, unfortunately, I'm the bearer of bad news. Research will show that 74% of the bullying is coming top down. So we know we have a heavy problem at leadership level. So board members need to become aware of what to ask for. Yes, but the answers can be skewed. So surveys are important and helpful, but make sure the person that's doing the survey is an external resource, because they don't trust the process internally. This is called institutional betrayal for a reason. The internal systems have betrayed them. The external systems have betrayed them. Internal being HR, internal being leadership, external being union. So you need to contract somebody that your employees would trust, where their confidentiality is 100% protected and the analysis and outcomes are absolutely factual, that they are not tainted in order for a nice big paycheck, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to trust, right? If you have these consultants coming in, but you know, at the end of the day, the consultants are reporting to the senior leadership team or whatever, and there's a member of that senior leadership team who is a bully, you know, how honest and candid can staff be for fear of that information coming back and biting them? And especially if it's a small organization, right? I mean, if you're in a unit of two people and your unit lead is a disaster, who's really going to be willing to speak up? Because, you know, this comment came from this unit. Well, okay, it was one of two people. So, you know, you really have to have that trust there. So that's a really, really good point.
By the time they get to that point, the trust is not there. You're talking about psychological safety. It's gone. Sometimes you have to reach outside in order to get some. When you're going through high stress or even trauma, our vision is really, really narrowed in order to survive, because we're just trying to get through one day. So our vision, we have to narrow it just to cope. And we've lost perspective on all the other answers, that potential answers that might be out there. And that's why I think suicides happen. You just get so traumatized. You're not seeing the full picture anymore. You're not full capacity. You're not left brain, right brain, body and mind is not on board anymore. It's just that lower brain of emotion and chaos. And when you're functioning on that level, it feels completely hopeless and terrifying. So that's why I keep saying, reach out, go and see somebody who can help you bring that entire perspective back on board again, help you cope, help you stabilize enough to make some rational decisions. That's why I say, don't quit until you see somebody. Get all the information back on board.
So if there are two or three really tangible things that a small to medium-sized organization with minimal resources could do to prepare for, be aware of, address, ensure it doesn't happen, bullying in the workplace, what would you advise these small organizations to do? Two or three things.
Well, number one, review your policies and procedures and make sure they align, all right, with legislation that includes protection for workers against psychological hazards like bullying and racism and discrimination. So make sure your policies and procedures are up to date, and there's very clear steps that if your supervisor's the bully, you go here. If your manager's the bully, you go here. If HR is the bully, you go here. Make sure it includes protection against retaliation. Make sure it includes consequences and even examples of retaliation, because that can be quite sneaky as well, right? So make it safe for people to report and make absolute sure they are protected. Make sure you as leaders follow your own policies because you are the role models. You set the tone of the work environment and your employees are watching you and they're following your lead, right? So zero tolerance, zero tolerance. You've got no problem if you follow that right there. Secondly, you can create your own training if you don't have the money to bring in. But a lot of us will negotiate with nonprofits and reduce our fee because we want the message out there. We want the message out there, right? So negotiate with us and to a fee that you can afford. Or maybe there's some sort of a bargain that can happen. So that's one, two. And then make sure, number three, that you have resources available if someone has suffered an injury. So a lot of us have employment assistance programs in our benefits, and some of us don't. But some of these employment assistance programs are not trained well in this area. At least provide your employee who's been injured with one session to see someone like us. Have somebody come in and do we call it brown bag lunch, where you sit down and you have somebody present for 45 minutes on trauma, on how to self-care, self-recovery tactics, how to prevent burnout, how to prevent vicarious trauma, how to prevent compassion fatigue. Keep this alive, keep everybody healthy and just team building and celebrate your successes. Make sure you're giving people credit for the work they've done. Give them that pat in the back. Don't take their credit away. Give them credit. Toxic leaders will take credit for your work and make you feel like you're not doing it good enough. So do the opposite of that. Build people up. You can build each other up as well. And make it okay to talk about it. I do the Workplace Bullying Awareness Week every October. Get involved in that because that role models where you stand. So make it something people talk about. Don't silence this and role model.
Those are great suggestions, and I'm glad that they are low to no cost because a lot of times, and no excuse, but a lot of times, small nonprofits are just going to say, I believe in this. I don't want this to happen. I just don't have the resources for a fancy consultant or the time to write a massive policy. But what you're saying is it doesn't take a lot of resources. It doesn't take a massive policy. It takes the right fit for purpose documentation, the right fit for purpose processes, and you can find low to no resource solutions for this. And like you said, being nice to each other and building each other up, that doesn't cost anything, right?
No, it doesn't. You know, review your mission, review your vision, review your values together and open up the conversation, make it safe to talk about it. And some of us fancy consultants will offer, sometimes we do it for free. Sometimes we'll do it for a very low cost, depending on the case, because we care enough, you know, so don't just assume that we won't.
That's great, Linda. So you've been working on this area of bullying for teenagers, and I'm sure that it has changed a lot over time. What would be some learning platforms or continuing education opportunities that you could recommend for folks in the third sector who are interested in learning more, who want to make sure that they're staying on top of this so that they can build a positive working environment, handle bullies if they show up in their workplace? Where can they go to do some reading or learn more that might not, you know, require them to get a master's degree?
There is a gazillion research papers. There's at least 400 of them, I think. I've also got some books that I can recommend. So I'll send you a couple of links that you can put out there for people and to different organizations as well. I'll create a sheet for you and send that off to you.
That would be amazing. We can make sure we put that in the show notes. And anything you have for an international community would be great as well. Yeah. Is there anything that we didn't cover? Anything that you think would be a really good parting thought or advice or guidance for small to medium-sized organizations that are concerned about and want to better manage workplace bullying?
Well, we've talked about leadership. We've talked about the respondents, right? The people that have been acting out with disruptive behaviors are called respondents. We've talked about the complainants, the ones that are targeted, but we haven't talked about the witnesses, the bystanders. So I think it's important to say that when I went through this, I was furious with my bystanders. I was let down. That's another part of that betrayal, by the way. The injury is a trauma of betrayal because they all put their heads down or they all pretend they don't see anything. And well, I used to have a lot of resentment, but now I have learned a great deal more. There is a lot of valid reasons for people who don't want to speak up. So I want to take that shame away. Number one, they might have been bullied before and they sure as heck don't want to be bullied again. Understandable and valid. They might be going through a divorce, or maybe they have a child at home with cancer or a spouse, or maybe they themselves have cancer. That's a valid reason not to want to get involved in this chaos. They might not know what to do, and that's why training is important, and that's valid. They might be on probation and scared to rock the boat and lose their job. They need that permanent position. They need those benefits. And so they're just going to keep quiet and stay under the radar. These are all very, very valid. They've also seen the process fail where people have reported before, and it has failed. So it's valid. They're valid. So we have to try and make it safe for bystanders and witnesses for them to come and talk to someone as well. Because some of them, sure, they'll join the side of the bullies. There's no doubt about that. But some of them are scared of conflict and they feel awful about it. They're carrying that stress on top of everything else. And those are the ones that I really want to help. We can help you by providing a safe place for you to talk about, look at all the different things that are happening in your life, and help you get to that place where you can report and do the right thing at the end of the day. And it will come on your terms. And I just think that's really important, that we need to understand that bystanders have a story too.
That's a really good thing to add here, because a lot of times you might be sitting in a meeting, for example, and a bully is just going to be going after somebody and everybody just sits around the table and they look down and they're quiet and no one says anything.
Exactly.
And people are so afraid to speak up. And then the person who's getting bullied sits there and goes, well, wait a minute, am I doing something wrong? Because no one else is saying anything, but this doesn't feel right. And of course, people around the table are going, oh my God, make it stop. Why is this happening? But it's hard for people to speak up. There are non-escalation things that they can do to get involved. But as you said, there might be reasons why they don't. And that's the world we live in.
I want to take the judgment away and say to them, you need to document anyway, whether you plan to report it or not, document anyway, because, you know, things change for you. Maybe it's changed that you're now being targeted and you're going to want to report because something has just pushed you over the edge and it's time for you to report. Well, you're not going to remember what happened in November. You're going to forget what happens in December. You're going to need those notes in order to, number one, maintain your clarity, because you get very confused when these things are happening. You get very fatigued. This kind of abuse attacks your confidence. And with clarity and confidence, you're going to maintain your courage, right? And your courage is going to be needed in order for you to make a complaint. And with a complaint, you are going to need to be credible. And consistency with your notes is going to show that you are credible. So I say to you as a bystander, even though you're scared and I'm never going to report, no matter what, document, just document, because it could save your life or somebody else's when it's time, when you need to make that complaint, or maybe a group of you decide to come together and make that complaint. Your notes are going to be critical for that investigation.
That's great advice. Thanks, Linda. So if people are really interested in reaching out to you to learn more about what you do or talk to you further, where can they find you?
One word, psychologicalsafetyfirst@gmail.com.
And I know you're pretty active on LinkedIn as well. In fact, I'm a big follower. I love what you post on the topic. So I'll encourage people to follow Linda on LinkedIn too. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Linda. I really appreciate it. This has been such a great and eye-opening and very informative conversation. And I hope the folks listening today feel more confident, more empowered, and more brave, I guess, to stand up if they need to. So thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I want to end on a positive note. Again, what I said at the beginning, things are changing. This is not going away. There's plenty of us around the world fighting for your safety. So that's a positive note to hope to end on.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you so much, Linda.
You're welcome.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.